Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I really appreciate the fact that the Democrat congresswoman who represents much of the Richmond area in her first term in Congress, Abigail Spanberger, has agreed to come on the air with us today. And I've got to start, Congresswoman Spanberger, by thanking you and also asking you what you think over the last 2 weeks. Are you prepared to actually vote to impeach President Trump based on what you've heard?
Well, thank you so much for having me on, John. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners. You know, I think what we've heard over the past couple weeks, the past 2 weeks of public hearings, have been significant testimony regarding the allegations involving the president and the president's actions or alleged actions. I am on one of the committees of jurisdiction from the time when there were closed hearings, so I did attend many of those hearings and certainly read through depositions of those. I wasn't able to attend for their entirety. And I remain of the position that the allegations of the president against the president are substantial. And just for your listeners' background, I hadn't been in favor of an impeachment inquiry until the allegations regarding Ukraine and the potential withholding of a meeting, which would be of great value to a fledgling democracy at war with Russia, and to the idea that security assistance dollars, taxpayer, congressionally appropriated dollars were potentially being withheld from a fledgling democracy at war with Russia for the purposes of a investigation into the president's political rival and potentially the public announcement of said investigation. Mm-hmm. Those, for me, those allegations are dramatic. They represent a national security threat. They are deeply, deeply disturbing. And as I said when I first came out in favor of an inquiry, these allegations do represent impeachable offenses, and we need all of the facts and evidence. What we've seen, both in the depositions that have been made public from the closed-door hearings and now the 2 weeks' worth of public testimony, is we have seen many witnesses come forward and fill out a lot of the questions in the time frame and timeline related to these allegations involving the president. What we haven't seen is very many people or anyone coming forward and disputing the veracity of these allegations or explaining how it is that this aid was intended to be withheld and was held for some time, that the Ukrainians were aware of it. And as Ambassador Sondland, a Trump appointee, a President Trump appointee, said that there was a quid pro quo relationship relative to a meeting and potentially the security assistance dollars. In terms of an actual vote, the next process or the next step in this process is for the inquiry to move to the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee is going to weigh everything that came forth in prior testimony within the Intelligence Committee and then decide whether or not to move forward with drafting articles of impeachment. And as of right now, there's no clear idea of what will or will not be drawn up, if anything. And so, you know, as is my way, I'm not going to commit to vote one way or the other until I know what we will actually be voting for or not.
There's been a counter narrative. You've articulated very clearly what I think Democrats are saying, but there's been a counter narrative that, yes, it's a fledgling democracy, but it's a very corrupt democracy, and that Joe Biden himself raised the specter that there's been impropriety with his family, and that deserves to be looked at. And I think Republicans, if we were to have one of your colleagues on, they'd say they feel like they've been hampered at bringing their own witnesses in to try to offer that counter narrative on the public stage. Do you think the next committee that will handle this will be a little more balanced than Republicans would assert this committee has with the hearings we've watched publicly so far?
So, and John, the points that you've just raised are ones that I've had discussions directly with many of my Republican colleagues and my Republican friends about this issue. Mm-hmm. And I think there's two pieces. One, I can't specifically answer what the Judiciary Committee will or won't do. I don't serve on that committee, and I don't yet know or haven't heard about what they are planning to do in this next phase. So just lay that out there, that I don't actually know what their plans are. But in respects to the discussion related to the Bidens, corruption within Ukraine, you know, it's well known that this fledgling democracy, former Soviet country, has in fact struggled for years with corruption within its ranks. It's something that has been a priority for ally nations throughout Europe and the Western Hemisphere to try and assist and advocate for clamping down on corruption within Ukraine, and certainly. That is vitally, vitally important. But separate from that, I think the question of whether or not there was any engagement or any challenges, or, you know, be it appropriate, inappropriate, with Joe Biden's son, that is a separate issue from whether or not the president did something inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And so, what
but
I have
should it be? I mean, he's the one that asked for the investigation.
Yeah. So in my conversations with my colleagues, one of the things that I say is, you know, we have the best law enforcement agencies in the world. If the president had concerns about corruption, as prior presidents have related to Ukraine and other fledgling democracies, former Soviet countries, he could have gone to Department of Justice, and through engagement with Department of Justice, with FBI, if there was any evidence of wrongdoing of a United States citizen, as Joe Biden's son is, that would be the means by which we would investigate any efforts or any potential wrongdoing.
Which I think was happening, right? I mean, that...
And they had been cleared of any potential wrongdoing. So that's another element, is that essentially, you know, we're looking at what allegations had or hadn't existed. U.S. law enforcement determined that there was nothing, and here the president was saying, we'd like to see a public investigation or a public announcement into this family.
Based on what they knew. Yeah.
And the important piece here, I think, is that, you know, if there is to be or if there's reason to have any investigation into Joe Biden's son, that his potential wrongdoing, if it's there, if it's not there, and I'm not going to weigh in because I have no evidence one way or the other, except for the fact that the FBI has said there has been none. So I'll believe the FBI for this. For the purposes of this conversation.
You're generous, but that's okay.
Well, I've worked with the FBI, and they're an incredible cadre of public servants.
I know, and I hate to be the one to even second-guess them, but I think we're at a stage where that's not unreasonable to do. But
no, John, I'll disagree with you there. I think it's wholly unreasonable. We have lifelong public servants who are committed to the rule of law in keeping our country safe from terrorism, keeping our country safe, you know, rescuing children who have been kidnapped, stopping bank robberies.
Well, we're just going to have to disagree on that based on what I've seen for the last 3 years. So let me let you wrap on that. And I know you want to talk about the trade deal, so I don't want to
I would raise the point of what's been seen in the last 3 years have just been attacks on public servants, right? So this is discussion. There's not actual evidence of this. And if there are evidence of this, there's offices of inspector general that could be used. And so we should always endeavor to investigate ourselves. There's oversight. There's the oversight committees, which prior to January 2019 were the majority party was the Republican Party. If there was issues related to any domestic entity, the oversight exists with Congress, and those oversight capabilities could have been used to look into any challenges. But
I'm hoping,
you know,
we'll get
done.
some reports that will validate this. I mean, and not hoping. It's a pretty terrible situation. But let me sideline that and get to the trade deal, because I know you wanted to talk about that. Is Nancy Pelosi going to let the USMCA progress through the House or not?
So I think there's, and let me just tell you where we are on this. So USMCA, and I know most of your listeners know this, it's a trade deal, basically NAFTA 2.0 between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And the agreement was made, and now it is up to each individual country to vote on what are called the implementing documents. So we will have to change U.S. law in order to conform with USMCA. Mm-hmm. So Congress is not yet able to take a vote because we have not received the implementing documents from the White House.
Okay.
And which is, I'm not putting it on the White House, what that means is we're not at a place yet where we can take a vote. The good news is that we have had multiple USMCA-related meetings within the House of Representatives, specifically within the Democratic caucus. Even just yesterday, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and Chairman Neal met with U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Lighthizer to talk about what the current progress is. At a meeting last week, we had an update from the working group. So the current process is there's been some challenges related to the USMCA and some questions that, and all particularly Democrats said wanted answered. One of them is whether or not the trade deal makes it harder for generic drugs to get to market in the United States. And so as prescription drug pricing is such an important issue for so many people throughout the United States, entering into a trade deal that could potentially make it harder for generics to come to market in the U.S. is a challenge and one that we're concerned about.
Okay.
The other issue relates to labor enforcement. So USMCA, as it's drafted, the trade agreement is has improvements on labor standards over what we have in NAFTA. The challenge is, what is the enforcement mechanism of that? So that's one of the things that these working group has been working out. My understanding from my colleagues who serve on that working group, they've been giving me regular updates, is that those discussions are going very well, that Ambassador Lighthizer has been incredibly responsive. I have personally met with Ambassador Lighthizer multiple times, as well as his deputy, Mr. Mahoney. They have been very forward-leaning, given us significant access, you know, to me as a first-term member. I've met with them multiple times, either in a group or by myself, and I think that that's been really, really valuable.
Well, that's a positive, and I think that's something even our next guest, who's on the other end of the political spectrum, you know, the former Governor George Allen, every time he comes on, he makes a point of pushing for this issue. So I'm glad that maybe there's some overlap between Republicans and Democrats.
Well, and I think it's a Virginia-specific issue, right? So, you know, there's no doubt that Central Virginia and Virginia overall would benefit from strengthened trade agreement between the United States and Canada. Virginia exports about $4.3 billion worth of goods to Canada and Mexico each year. And to have stability, and we have NAFTA right now, but to have increased stability
would be
valuable.
For us. Yeah.
And there's the USMCA is also even better for dairy farms. And we don't have a lot of dairy farms in the 7th District, currently have, I believe, 16. But it is significantly better for dairy farms. You know, cattlemen in the northern portion of my district are excited at the prospect for greater trade stability to be able to sell Virginia cattle to Canada. And then we've had small business owners throughout Central Virginia that have given me really specific examples of the way this level of trade stability would benefit them, allow for them to grow their businesses in a real, you know, reasonable, helpful way, not just for them as small business owners, but for the larger economy, those they employ, and our communities overall.
That's important for all of
us. Absolutely.
Congresswoman, I hate to cut you off. I do really sincerely appreciate you coming on and having a candid conversation about this. Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, the Democrat who represents the 7th Congressional District, thank you very much.
Thank you. I look forward to speaking with you again. Bye, John.
Thank you.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.